Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A federal judge last week blocked a Trump administration plan to end the U.S. Census a month early. That's the latest in a string of challenges to the once-in-a-decade national headcount. The stakes are high. The count determines congressional representation and how $1.5 trillion in federal funding is distributed. Census Director Stephen Dillingham in House testimony in July reaffirmed the Bureau's core mission.
The nonpartisan U.S. Census Bureau is the nation's leading federal statistical agency. Its career and non-career staff work together to advance its mission, always in accordance with governing laws and court rulings.
New York Times national reporter Michael Wines has been covering developments with the census. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Happy to be here.
So you wrote in a piece for September 25th, you called it perhaps the most contested population count in a century. So I just mentioned the last ruling. What else has been in the courts over this?
Well, it's been a long, long road for the census. It started out in 2018 after the director of the census declared that there would be a citizenship question added to the 2020 questionnaire. That was immediately taken to court. There was a long court struggle over that ended in June 2019 with the Supreme Court ruling that it couldn't go on the census. There have been any number of lawsuits alleging that an undercount of minorities and other hard-to-reach census respondents would result in a skewed census. And of course, now it's come up to the issue of whether or not the census is going to be stopped early or not.
What's the strategy of stopping it a month earlier?
Well, it depends on who you talk to.
Okay.
The administration says that they have a statutory deadline to meet. And it's true. Congress has said that the preliminary population figures, the ones that will be used for reapportioning the House of Representatives, have to be delivered to the White House by the end of the year, by December 31st. The Trump administration has said the only way that they can do that is if they shorten the census, because it takes months and months of data processing just to get those figures ready. And in fact, the Census Bureau itself, which is, in my experience, almost religiously nonpartisan, the experts there, they have said there's no way you can get that data prepared by December 31st unless we stop the census early and start crunching the numbers. Now, the critics of the administration would say that that's just a subterfuge, that in fact there is legal precedent for missing that deadline if you don't think you're going to get an accurate count.
Yeah.
And they say the real reason that the administration wants to get those numbers to the White House by December 31st is that they don't want them to go to a potential Joe Biden presidency in 2021. And the reason for that is that President Trump in July issued an order commanding the Census Bureau to make an estimate of the number of unauthorized immigrants in each state and deliver them to him so that he could subtract them from the actual census totals when he sends them to the House for reapportionment. The census has always counted everybody, whether they're citizens or not, from the very first census in 1790. So this would be a history-making move on the president's part. And most people think that the effect of it would be to leave a population base for reapportionment that is whiter, has fewer children, fewer minorities than the existing one, and probably would favor the Republican Party.
And
critics of the president say that this is all about politics.
And does the president have the statutory authority to subtract those numbers from each other?
I think most people would say no. That, too, has been to court. The Constitution says that you count the whole number of persons in each state. It doesn't say you can subtract anybody. And the courts have already ruled against the president on that issue, saying that he doesn't have the authority to do that. But the Trump administration is going to appeal it.
It's understandable that the census has had road bumps along the way because of the pandemic. But I'm wondering, couldn't Congress just extend the due date from December 31st to, say, January 15th? I mean, hypothetically, I'm just wondering.
Congress absolutely could. And in fact, in April, the Trump administration said, we've got this pandemic. We don't have the time to conduct a proper census in the middle of a pandemic. Uh-huh. Give us more time. Let's extend the deadline for counting people to October 31st. And then let's extend the deadline for delivering data to the White House to 2021. So that by April 2021, that data would go to the states so that they could start reapportioning their own legislatures and redistricting.
Uh-huh.
So it was proposed by the president. But then in August, early August, shortly after he issued his order to make a count of unauthorized immigrants, they rolled that back and said, no, we need to have those numbers by December 31st.
And their reason why?
Their reason why as well, they just say we have a statutory deadline.
Okay. Okay. And any word on whether the Trump administration is going to appeal that September 25th ruling by U.S. District Federal Judge Lucy Coe?
Yeah. They're going to take it to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. It will be appealed.
And
many people expect this to wind up in the Supreme Court.
Ha. Okay. What about the administration's plan to remove undocumented immigrants from the count? Now, is that, you said that's just something he wants to do. That's not in the statutes, right?
Well, in fact, there's another legal issue there.
Okay.
Congress has passed legislation saying that for purpose, when you have statistics that are being sent for purposes of reapportionment, that you cannot use estimates. You have to have real hard numbers. So that would seem to make it illegal for the president to actually achieve these estimates of undocumented, unauthorized immigrants and use them as part of the census for reapportionment.
Because by definition, if you're subtracting an estimate from a fact number, then you're ending up with an estimate.
That's exactly right. If you don't have a firm number of how many unauthorized immigrants there are, mm-hmm. then you have to make an estimate, and that estimate simply can't be used.
Evidence at the hearing included internal communication from top census officials, and I think it showed they don't agree with this. I mean, they want to take as much time as they can get to get an accurate headcount, right?
Right. The census people, as I said, they're career civil servants. Most of them are demographers, statisticians, numbers crunchers, and they've been doing this, many of them, for decades. And their assessment has been really since April that there is no way that you can wrap this up on September 30th and have an acceptably accurate count. In fact, they've said this publicly in July. That it's just impossible to get those numbers to the White House by December 31st at this point because we just don't have the time to do it.
Through all this litigation and this and that, have they lost days of work on the census already?
I think the senior officials in the Census Bureau have lost a lot of time. There is a working committee of top officials that has been working on this estimate of unauthorized immigrants. There's been a lot of time spent on depositions, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. In the field, they started late, but they started on schedule, and they're still counting. So I don't think that you can say that they have actually lost time, except that because they have shortened the deadline for completing the counting portion from October 31st to September 30th, they've taken a month off of it. And so we're going to have a historically short period for counting Americans.
What segments of the population are most vulnerable to undercounting during a typical census, let alone this one?
In almost every census, you find the same groups are being undercounted. Young people, minorities, people who are immigrants, who are foreign-born or recently foreign-born, and that just doesn't include just Latinos. Mm-hmm. It's Asian Americans and many other ethnicities. And the reason for that, there are many reasons, actually. Young people and the poor in particular tend to live in apartments. They can't afford houses. When you live in an apartment, you move quite a bit. And so it's easy to miss you in the census. minorities, or a lot of them are traditionally suspicious of dealing with the government, particularly undocumented immigrants.
And is it fair to say that mostly we're talking about people who tend to live in big cities led by Democrats?
For the most part, yes, but you can't really generalize.
Yeah.
Take Texas, for instance. There are a lot of minorities who are living in rural areas along the Rio Grande Valley.
Mm-hmm.
They may lean Democratic, but they're not urban residents. And in fact, demographers say increasingly that a lot of the undercounts in censuses are taking place in rural areas, which are sparsely populated, harder to reach, maybe not as connected by the internet and other things as cities are. So this is going to hit Republicans as well as Democrats.
The Trump administration recently installed two political appointees in senior roles at the census. Nathaniel, I think it's Coakley or Coakley, and Adam Korzenewski. What's the deal there? What are their qualifications? Is this relevant?
Actually, they've installed three political appointees.
Okay.
They also named a deputy director for data about a month ago, and I'm told that there's going to be a fourth that will be put in place this week. So they put in a lot of political appointees in an agency that has never had more than three or four political appointees to begin with. Professor Coakley comes from a small college in Texas. He is a political scientist. Has spent much of his time as a scholar in Africa, studying comparative politics there. It's hard to say that he has a lot of qualifications to be named a deputy director of the Census Bureau, but that's where he is. Mr. Korzenewski was a Republican political consultant for some time. His most recent job was as a temporary census taker in the New York area.
Okay. That's interesting. And retaining, by the way, census workers has been an ongoing issue during the pandemic. Has it been tougher during the pandemic than normal or what?
Yeah, they've had a real problem. They've had an enormous amount of attrition among enumerators, people who simply decided, even after applying for the job, that, no, I don't want to go out there and stand on doorsteps and risk getting COVID-19. I'm just going to drop out. I think they've had something like a 30% attrition rate, which is much higher than normal.
You wrote that even with the decision on that you reported on September 25th, blocking the administration's plan for a shortened census, that top people in the Census Bureau say it's clear, quote, that the battle to achieve its goal not only will continue, but holds a potential for yet another political crisis. How so a political crisis?
Well, there are any number of routes that this fight could take. As I said, it's probably going to go to the Supreme Court. We don't know how the court will rule. And if, in fact, if there's even time to rule on it. But if you have a census at the end of the year that a large number of people in Congress think mayors, governors think is inadequate, that could be taken to court. You could have a lawsuit simply saying you can't use this census. It's not adequate. If, in fact, the president does send to Congress numbers that do not include immigrants, undocumented or unauthorized immigrants, those numbers go to the House of Representatives, which then sends them to the states for redistricting and reapportionment, and also uses them to redistrict the House. Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic Speaker of the House, could simply say, nope, we're not going to reapportion the House. We're not going to use figures that are not accurate to do this.
And she could just stop the process there.
Well, she could stop the process. Under law, the numbers do go to the states. And as I said, there would certainly be a long court battle over whether or not you can include undocumented and unauthorized immigrants in those population totals. But yes, she could stop reapportionment of the House. And in fact, that's been done once before in 1920. They went for 20 years without reapportioning the House because of an argument that was basically political.
Wow. Okay. And then one more question. I hate to keep you, but I have one more question. This has been a largely computerized population count for the first time ever. But as we've mentioned already, the coronavirus pandemic, and then you mentioned in your story, wildfires, hurricanes, and a swelling distrust of government. I'm thinking like wildfires and hurricanes. Let's just stop there. How do they do a census when, you know, people are, thousands of people are being driven from their homes and they're burning down? And how does that work?
Yeah, it's been almost biblical for these people. It's such a tragedy. They spend 10 years planning for this 2 or 3 months where they're supposed to count everybody. And look what's happened. You know, it's just been amazing. It's an excellent question. You know, you're not only supposed to count every resident of the country, but you're also supposed to count them where they were on April 1st.
Right.
Now, how do you go about doing that? You know, you find college students, you know, who are supposed to be counted in their dorms or in their off-campus apartments. The college shuts down. They go home. Do they fill out their census form saying I was living in my college town on April the 1st?
Or I would have been if it hadn't been for the pandemic.
Or I would have been because that's where they're supposed to be counted. But they wind up being counted with their families. You have a coronavirus. People lose jobs. They move in with relatives because they can't afford rent. You know, will these people actually fill these forms out properly? And if they don't, how do you track them down? A census taker goes to, for instance, an apartment house and goes up to a door and says to this person, did you live here on April 1st? And he or she says no. And the census taker says, well, do you know who was living here? Oh, no, I have no idea. So the potential for an inaccurate count is certainly large.
Well, Michael Wines, thanks so much for taking some time to talk with us about it today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Michael Wines is a reporter, national reporter for the New York Times, covering the census and its challenges. We're going to continue our conversation. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. A federal judge has blocked a Trump administration order to end the U.S. Census a month early. As it stands, the once-in-a-decade count will proceed until October 31st. But Census Bureau employees still face the challenges of a pandemic, unprecedented presidential involvement, and a host of legal challenges. John Casterline is director of the Institute for Population Research at Ohio State University. He's past president of the Population Association of America, the leading professional organization for demographers in the U.S. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Thanks for having me.
Susan Licata is a spokesperson for the Philadelphia Regional Census Center, which covers 9 states, including Ohio. Welcome to the show, Susan.
Good morning. Thank you.
Susan, the count has started up again. Where is Ohio in the process?
Sure. And actually, the count never stopped. You know, we opened the opportunity for folks to respond to the census in early March of 2020, and we continue. Ohio is doing very well. And let me provide that larger picture first. Nationally, we're at 97.9%. Ohio is at 98.7% for self-response and non-response follow-up.
What does that mean, non-response follow-up?
So non-response follow-up is the phase that is where the census taker, also known as an enumerator, will visit those households that have not yet responded. And non-response follow-up began nationwide in early August. It was a staggered start, depending on local and state guidelines with respect to the pandemic.
Right. So what role has the pandemic played in the challenges? Because as I was just talking with Michael Wines of the New York Times, we don't have hurricanes and wildfires in Ohio, but we do have the pandemic and people have moved. They've had to leave. They've had to move in with their parents. How do you fix all of that during all the impacts of the pandemic?
Well, some of the operational timelines had changed. Certainly, we had to halt our field operations and make those adjustments, which we did. And we still wanted to, and it was necessary to ensure everybody was counted, as we say, once and only once and in the right place. And some of those folks were displaced, especially college students who were faced with having to leave their college campuses
right
in the middle of their semester. And so there was a lot of concern about how will we properly count the college students. And so the Census Bureau worked very, very quickly with its outreach to colleges and universities nationwide to express the how to count to the college officials, as well as get the word out to the families, so that we knew that, education here literally was the key of how to count these college students. If they moved back home, where would they have normally been as of April 1st? So it was a pretty massive effort to make sure we got that word out. And the way we did that was not in a singular manner. We leveraged our partnership team, which we had partnership specialists across the country that worked within each county. And those counties that had colleges were no exception, to make sure we had, the right lines of communication open to share the importance of how to count those college students.
John Kasterlein, as a demographer, what are your thoughts about this census and the challenges that have been posed?
Well, this one really is exceptional. It's just as the other two persons have said. That April 1st date, we point to every 10 years. It's a very special date. There's a whole process, enormous investment of resources and persons targeted towards that date. And so what happens? The pandemic kicks in a couple weeks before. And then we've had the other complications. Let me say, as a demographer, Michael Wine said, professionals of many decades of work. And I think they can achieve a successful census this year, despite all these obstacles. But they do need the time. And I'm hopeful it will actually now go through October for the field work. And the other point, it's a little hard to explain to the general public, but the Census Bureau really needs a whole bunch of months to work with the data after the field work is completed, to get it in order, to tidy things up, to correct inconsistencies. And typically that's right now under the schedule the administration has asked for. If field work goes through October, they'll have just 2 months till the end of December to do that post-field work reconciliations, adjustments. But they really need more time than that. They need, 5 months would be ideal.
Okay, so
given that time, I think it can be a successful census despite everything.
All right. So at this point, Susan Licata, they're going to keep the census going through October 31st as it stands, at least the last court ruling. I know the Trump administration is going to appeal that ruling. But be that as it may, I'm wondering about how the pandemic, I mean, you said that 97% overall have completed the census. It's higher than 98% in Ohio, which is great. But how crucial are those other 2+ percentage points or 3 percentage points, going forward? Those are tougher to get, right?
Absolutely. We strive for 100%. We want folks to know and understand that it is their right to be counted. If you are living or staying in the United States as of April 1st, we need to count you. And so sharing that message of importance through to our counties and our partners across the country about the community benefit and why it's so important for everybody to be counted has been paramount. So the message has not changed. We need to ensure everybody has the opportunity to be counted. And with COVID, it actually provided us the opportunity to share the information that you could respond in a contactless manner. So folks have always had the opportunity to respond online, by phone, or by returning their paper form. And through non-response follow-up, if the census taker visited the household and perhaps somebody was not there or chose not to answer the door, a notice of the visit was there along with a paper form for the household to return. So there's plenty of opportunities, despite a pandemic, to respond. And also when those census takers come to the doorstep, they're in full PPE. You know, the Census Bureau issued a joint statement with the Centers for Disease Control in early August, saying that we are intentional to follow PPE guidelines and ensure that everybody is safe.
Is it the notion that the last few percentage points of people out there yet to be counted are not doing so, are not stepping up because of PPE, or is it more fear of having the numbers used against them, particularly if they're unauthorized immigrants?
Non-response is a variety of reasons, mm-hmm. quite frankly. And, you know, some may not be aware, some may be fearful, some may have barriers of communication, some may not understand how to fill out the census. And what we've done is worked very, very hard to ensure, and again, that's through our partnership, there's over 400,000 partners nationwide. And those are businesses and organizations that help us work with those hard-to-count populations and those low response score neighborhoods. Those folks provide the goods and services that are reaching people that tend to not respond to the census. And they're helping us share that message and really encourage their response.
John Casterline, is there a, you know, we've been talking a lot in recent months about our confidence in voting systems and that kind of thing. And there's a similar sort of confidence we have, or a quality of confidence that we have when it comes to something like the census, right? Mm-hmm. And what's, yeah. Is there a sense, or is anybody questioning the level of confidence we should have in the census, given the litigious nature of this one, the pandemic, the wildfires, the hurricanes, you know, on and on?
As I say, I think if it's allowed to continue through to the end, as the Census Bureau would like to, we can have a high level of confidence in the census. But I should say there are challenges of conducting the census that have persisted over the decades, and some of them have worsened. For example, the coverage of children we know is worse, probably about 5% under coverage.
Why is that? Do we
know? There are technical ways of kind of doing these assessments. You compare with birth registration and so forth, and you decide, you can make a judgment whether the census is capturing everybody, and children uh-huh. are missed. And Michael Wines touched on this a bit. It's a very, it's an interesting problem, not entirely understood. But one thing is the way childbearing is in this country, it is somewhat disproportionately in middle and lower income subgroups of the population mm-hmm. that are harder for the census to reach because they're in difficult neighborhoods.
They move a lot, yeah.
A lot of transient housing things. So children are disproportionately there. But it seems that there's another problem that has worsened over the last few decades, and that is that you know, children can't fill out their own census form, of course. It's filled out by their parents, their guardians, whomever. And there seems to be some confusion about whether children are to be listed. So this undercount, mind you, this undercount is 5% is 1 out of 20. So it's not like we're missing scads of children. But it seems that some of that is due to just a misunderstanding whether children are to be listed. There may be a feeling that someone else has listed them. Maybe that they actually should be listed by the grandparent, but they're listed in that the grandparent thinks they were listed in the household of the parent, or vice versa. Those kind of things. So it's a combination of factors, but it's a significant issue because, of course, you've mentioned that we use census numbers for a portionment of not just seats, electoral seats, but of monies, federal monies, mm-hmm. And state monies as well. And so you want to know where the children are. There are a number of programs, CHIPS, school lunch programs, and so forth that are targeted towards children. And the number of children matters. So,
and you said that it's 5%, 1 out of 20, so not SCADs, but do they tend to be concentrated in certain areas?
And they would be, yes.
Yeah.
They're almost certainly heavily in lower-income neighborhoods. But also, as I think as Susan mentioned, or maybe it was Michael, like the rural areas, more remote rural areas, which often are very poor as well, mm-hmm. I should say. So, I should also mention there's an undercount of certain minorities, African-Americans and Hispanics. The best estimate is 1.5 to 2% undercount in 2010 census. Whereas, interestingly, white non-Hispanics are, looks like we're 1% overcounted by some. So there was double counting. You know, it's supposed to be that what you're supposed to, when you fill out your census form, which looks like most everybody did, I did, you're supposed to list who was residing in that dwelling on April 1st.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there could be some confusion, you know, but maybe you don't get around to filling it out for a couple weeks or something, and somebody's changed households. So there's always a possibility of a few people getting counted in two different places. That happens, too.
Susan Licata, as John Kasterlein said, it seems to be unclear whether and when children should be counted. And when that 5% figure, I thought sounded high. I mean, but what do you understand about what's unclear about this? What are you learning about what's confusing people?
Right. And he's absolutely right. We know in 2010, children under 5 were the largest undercounted population nationwide.
And that's important.
It is important. We look at the impact of that in the community and how that affects services such as WIC or Head Start, the National School Lunch Program, Medicare, Medicaid, SNAP, ESL, to name a few.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's quite a bit. And, you know, households now are sometimes more complex. So you may have grandparents and grandchildren living together, or you may have folks who are not your relatives living together, or even roommates. And so there has been confusion. And again, what we've done is really worked to get the word out through our partnership program with those partners, those trusted voices that are providing the essential and necessary goods or services to folks to let them know how to count.
Like food banks, that kind of a thing, are you talking about?
Absolutely.
Doctors? Okay.
We have worked with food banks, food pantries, our faith-based leaders, mm-hmm. our schools, and that is schools in all areas, whether that's inner city, whether that's rural. We've had complete count committees established in each county across the country. And what's unique about a complete count committee is that it reflects the population of that county. So you may have a county that has a high concentration of rural people. You may have a county that has Amish. You may have a county that has a high proportion of migrant workers, to name a few. And so there are subcommittees within those complete count committees that, again, are those trusted voices and partner organizations that serve those folks that can help us get the message out of why it's so important to respond to their census.
And just one more question, Susan Licata, before I let you go. When I was talking to Michael Wines from the New York Times, we talked a little bit about a shortage of census workers at the front lines. How's that going in Ohio?
You know, Ohio's doing very, very well. I like to look at it and say, wow, you know, the momentum is strong, and we're going to just keep at it. We are appropriately staffed. We are in the field every day ensuring that those households that have not yet responded have the opportunity to respond. In addition to responding online by phone or returning the paper form or meeting with a census taker at their doorstep, we also have mobile questionnaire assistance events throughout the country. And those are almost like a pop-up location. And those are held, again, at those locations where folks receive or purchase their essential goods or services, such as a gas station or a grocery store, a pharmacy, a library, even now outside of food distribution centers and such. And that allows folks to sit down with a census taker, again, not at their home, but at a place that they are most comfortable, and respond one-on-one to record their response.
Susan Licata, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Susan Licata is a spokesperson for the U.S. Census Bureau for the Philadelphia Regional Census Center, which covers 9 states, including Ohio. John Kasterlein is going to stay with us. He's director of Ohio State's Institute for Population Research. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Before 1970, people of Spanish or Hispanic origin were recorded as white on the question of race in the U.S. Census. A decade later, 14.6 million U.S. residents self-identified as Latino. This year, that number is expected to exceed 60 million. Ohio numbers reflect a similar trend, but advocacy groups are concerned that this group could be undercounted because of Trump administration efforts to exclude unauthorized immigrants from the once-a-decade headcount. Still with us is John Kasterlein. He's director of the Institute for Population Research at Ohio State. He's past president of the Population Association of America, the leading professional organization for demographers in the U.S. Professor of Law, Sociology, and Chicano Studies at UCLA, Laura E. Gomez, is co-founder and faculty director of the Critical Race Studies Program. Her new book, published in August, is titled Inventing Latinos, A New Story of American Racism. Welcome to the show, Laura Gomez.
Thank you, Anne. Happy to be here.
What's your sense about this strategy to exclude unauthorized immigrants, an order that the federal court earlier this month rejected, but it's expected to be litigated all the way to the top? What do you make of it?
It's actually of a piece with the Trump administration's overall attitude toward Latinos, right? So you have somebody who announced his candidacy in summer 2015 by saying that Mexico is sending us criminals, that all Mexican men are rapists, and, you know, with this hyperbole, who keeps beating the drumbeat of, you know, the MS-13 gang, even though that's a really small gang and not, you know, responsible for a lot of crime, you know, comparatively.
Mm-hmm.
So then when you look at what he's done with the census, first he wanted to include a citizenship question, which hadn't been included on the census for more than half a century, and that would have deterred not only undocumented people, but also mixed status people. And that's so undocumented, it's probably 11.5 million people in the country, but people who live in mixed status household, meaning that there's at least one person in that household, typically say one parent, mm-hmm. and the rest, one parent who's undocumented, and the rest are American citizens, that's another 17 million. So it would have had this deterrence effect, and I think that when he threatens to two things. When he threatens to say, I'm not going to include the undocumented people in the final count, which, of course, he can't do, and the court has said that. And when he threatens to, when the Trump administration says we're going to shorten the count for the census, and therefore we're going to put at risk the accuracy of the count,
mm-hmm.
those are all of a piece with this anti-Latino strategy. And you know, it's both a kind of a racism, but it's also practical politics, right? Where do Latinos live, and where do they influence where congressional districts are going to be? We know what the answers to those questions are.
And the other point that I made at the opening is that there are a lot more of them than there were 30 or 40 years ago.
Well, yeah, and I want to correct one thing that you mentioned, because you mentioned there wasn't, in 1970 we started counting Latinos, but it's actually 1980.
Okay, I apologize.
So no, that's okay. I just wanted to. It's only 40 years, right? Only 40 years, which is kind of remarkable, right? So, before we had that data nationally, we just thought, oh, there are Mexican Americans in the Southwest, and there are Puerto Ricans in New York and New Jersey, and there are Cuban Americans in Florida, right? They were these regional groups. But, you know, today, of course, there are Latinos who live in every state of the union, right? And if you look at what some people call the Latino spending power, that actually would make us as strong. I think it comes out to maybe being fifth in the world if you just metaphorically, hypothetically put Latinos, the 60 million of us, into one economy, right? So that is quite an increase, and it's expected to be 30% of the U.S. population within a few decades.
And, you know, John Kasterlein, I know what what Laura Gomez is saying here when we make assumptions about regions. When I moved to Ohio 30-odd years ago, I was surprised, but was always a big Latino, Hispanic, migrant worker population that ended up settling in Ohio. And I guess because of the tomato fields or something. And
Yeah, I should say from a national standpoint, the Latino population in Ohio is small. It's a smaller fraction than many states, certainly across the South and Southwest. But it's growing, and it's concentrated in certain areas, certainly in metropolitan areas, and because of the historic reason you gave, and some of the more agricultural areas in the northwest of the state. I just want to endorse what Singh said. Getting that count correct by race and ethnicity, including Latino versus others, is one of the really important functions of the census. Because it's a complete count, you have a chance to really get a picture of where the various groups that make up the United States population, where they're located. And in Ohio, we'd like to know, you know, we have 88 counties. We'd like to know where the Latinos are, where the African Americans are, with some precision. Mm-hmm. The census, if it's accurate, it gives us a chance to obtain that. So I think I'll say, for the reasons it was just given, Laura gave, I think the for demographers, well, for everyone, a real watch for number out of this census will be the Latino population, how large it is and where it's located, because every reason to fear that there will be an undercount this time around.
Laura Gomez, so on one hand, there's an important stake in this that all minority groups, but, you know, this very fast-growing minority group, I guess if you want to call it that, get counted for all the reasons, all the good government, all of the representational issues, all of the funding issues of money flowing from the federal government, all of that. And yet, on the other side of that coin, or the other problem is that there's a lot of reason to fear it too, at least in the community. What are you seeing as far as efforts to get the right count done?
Well, almost entirely that happens at the very local level, right? So, you know, it's sort of the kinds of things that your previous guest was talking about, right? Going to the right community centers and religious communities and, you know, trying to, at the grassroots level, get people. I know that there's been, in Los Angeles, for example, where I am, there's been a lot of Spanish language advertising about the census, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but most of that happens at the local level. I just want to come back to something that John was saying a minute ago, which is, you know, it's important to keep in mind that why is it that we're quibbling about the accuracy, you know, to the 99th percentile of the census? Well, it's because the Constitution says that we have to count everyone in the country, every person. It doesn't say every citizen or every adult. It says everyone, right? And, you know, there was just a ruling on Friday by a district judge here in California, a federal district judge, that is nationwide, that is basically telling the Trump administration, you cannot shorten the time period for data collection, and you can't shorten the time period for data processing at the census itself. I don't know if you've already talked about that.
Just a little bit, but it's critical. I mean, it's a critical thing that they have enough time to do a proper count.
Right. And one of the things that, you know, people are saying, well, this is going to be appealed and, you know, it's going to be overturned. But I'm telling you, I've read that district court opinion by Judge Lucy Coe, and it is rock solid, you know, and the evidence coming from the government itself, including the Census's Scientific Advisory Committee, the Department of Commerce Inspector General. In other words, all those bodies are actually saying, we should not be cutting this short, right? And so it kind of raises that question that we saw with the citizenship question when it went up to the Supreme Court last summer. I guess now it's been 14 months or so. It's like, what is the motive of the Trump administration? And it's hard to conclude that there's anything other than a nefarious political motive, which is I want to depress the count of certain people or certain states.
Even though, you know, you said, why are we quibbling about accuracy to 99%? But statistically, when we get to that last 2 or 3 percentage points, those tend to be the kinds of people who tend to be undercounted. That's what makes them so important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, I mean, populations like the homeless, right?
Yes.
That's incredibly vulnerable. Population. Your last guest, I heard just the tail end of that conversation. You guys were talking about children, right?
Right.
So when you think about the two demographic groups in the country that are the youngest, that's Asian Americans and Latinos. And the youngest just in terms of their median age, right? So that's where you have children concentrated, and that's where you are going to have disproportionately immigrants. Now, let me just be clear about that. Most Asian Americans are not immigrants. Most Latinos are not immigrants, but most immigrants are Asian or Latino, right?
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, you're going to have children in those, and those are the children, you know, when we think about the $1.5 trillion in federal funding that is determined on the basis of the census. Much of it is going to those poor neighborhoods and poorly funded, you know, we call them Title I schools, right? So trying to get that that kind of macro-level government safety net to those vulnerable populations.
And John Kasterlein, we're just about out of time, but even in Ohio, the number of Latinos almost doubled from 2010 to 2019. So this is important in Ohio as well.
That's right. It's absolutely growing. And more generally, without immigrants, Ohio's population would have been declining during the last decade.
Right.
It's a kind of a slight effect, but it actually means that we're still growing. So the contribution of immigrants to Ohio is meaningful. It's a net positive to our growth rate, and a good portion of that will be from Latin American countries, but also Asia. And Africa as well. In Columbus area, of course, we have a couple of immigrant communities that are from Africa.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
So it's and I want to underscore what Laura said.
We're just about out, but go ahead, John, real quick.
Well, just that the undercount is disproportionately those subgroups, which are really the target of very various social services, public services, provided by the federal government, provided by state governments, and even provided by private NGOs. So information is power is our stance here, and the census ought to be accurate. Then the politics can kick in, but let's at least get the count right.
John Kasterlein, Director of Ohio State's Institute for Population Research, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
And Laura Gomez, author and professor of law, sociology, and Chicano studies at UCLA. Just want to mention her new book is titled Inventing Latinos, a new story of American racism. Laura, thank you so much for your time today.
I enjoyed it, Ann. Bye-bye.
That's it. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.